Blog Talk Radio.
Listening to The Cosmic Citizen on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Paula Thompson, and with me are two great friends and co-hosts, Crystal and Beek Larson and Andre Redatus. Hi, you guys.
Good morning,
Paula.
Good morning, world.
Good morning, Crystal.
And let the day begin. And, you know, we have a great guest today. I'm really excited about our guest today. We're coming back with guns a-blazing, as you could say. Last week we had Jeff Waddles. We loved that show. I love that show. And if you didn't get to listen to it last week, please check it out on the archive. It was really a great show. And this week we have Matthew Wayland Fox. But he goes by Matthew. And he has an amazing story. And I just want to preface it by saying that most of us, you know, I so tune in to the heart of my Lord and Master Jesus Christ. And I often think when I'm downtrodden or troubled that I have a true friend in him, because I will never suffer as he did. I will never be falsely accused. I will never, you know, very likely won't be, you know, crucified. I know that. But even the idea of being falsely accused, you know, being run up into a kangaroo court and being thrown into a system that where the deck is stacked and where he didn't get a fair shot and where he was so horribly treated, that won't happen to me. I won't be that misunderstood. But Matthew, welcome to the show. I know that has happened to you. You've actually been through that, probably the worst thing that could happen to anybody. And you've come out on the other side, a sort of redemption. And so I'm very much looking forward to hearing your story. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Paula. It's a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to sharing my story. I think that it could have some value for people out there. It's a humbling experience, and I'm really excited to be able to share it again. It's been a while ago, and I've sort of distanced myself from the experience, but it, you know, it's taught me some of the greatest lessons of my entire life. So very happy to share.
Well, I have a lot of questions, and I know that Crystalline and Andre do too. So I'm going to throw it out there. Crystalline, do you want to start with some questions, or
I would just like to have a little
of your personal backgrounds before this sort of cycle of challenges related to the charges started. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your life before all of this happened.
Yeah, it thank you. It's interesting because I guess I'll go back to 1985. 1985 was a significant day, a year in my life, and I stopped. I had a drinking problem, actually, and I had I was a child of the 60s and got into all of the experimentation back then, and it was all fairly innocent back then, but it developed into a pretty severe problem for me. And in 1985, I put all that away, I put all that aside, and actually through the help of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was able to stop all that life and come into a way of life that is based upon spiritual principles. So it was not a matter of, you know, choice for me, really. It was a matter of life and death. So I chose to live. And the consequences of that choice were that I had to find a way to live on a spiritual base. Interestingly enough, I went to work for John Bradshaw. John Bradshaw is a well-known author and speaker. I worked for him for about 10 years, starting in about 1990. And the interesting thing is that the whole effort and the whole purpose of that work was to speak out against child abuse and addiction and try to offer understanding of those things to people on a worldwide basis. I was managing an audio, video, and cassette library for John, and I've sent tapes and stuff all over the world regarding these issues of particularly child abuse. And it's so interesting that later on I was falsely accused of the very thing that I had been speaking out against for many, many years.
Well, and for our listeners who aren't familiar with John Bradshaw, you know, he was one of the people who wrote a lot about the series of dysfunctions, I guess, that occur in alcoholic families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Healing the Shame That Binds You is one of his famous books. He was on PBS for years and years with family systems theory and talking about, I mean, I think he really popularized both the healing available in Alcoholics Anonymous and other 12-step programs and Al-Anon, which was much, much less known at the time than Alcoholics Anonymous and was the other side of family systems theory. And so the fact that you got to work with John Bradshaw, Matthew, is pretty remarkable. He is probably one of the unsung heroes today that many of us in the 80s will have remembered.
One of the fathers of the recovery movement, without a doubt. I mean, there was a huge recovery movement in the 90s and self-help movement in the 90s, and Bradshaw was certainly one of the founders and fathers of that whole movement, and a voice that was so amazing. So, wow, that was what a treat that you got to work with him. He's a wonderful speaker. He's a deeply spiritual person, too, and always impressed me as having a really good heart.
Well, he's just a wonderful man. I just spoke with him a few days ago, and he called to tell me about the release of his new book. He's got a new book that'll be out soon, and John is he's 83 now, so he is still writing, and his mind is sharp. He walks with a cane, but so he's physically not as up to speed as he once was, but his mind is just incredibly sharp. And he's written a new book, and it's the name. You guys will like this book. The name of this book, it's called Post Romantic Stress Disorder.
Oh boy! Yeah. Gotta love that.
Yeah,
so it's pure Bradshaw, you know, is what he is, and he's of course he's developed his thesis over the years of his writing, and this is another way of talking about you know, marital relationships and other relationships, intimate relationships, that, you know, what happens after the thrill goes away. So he writes brilliantly about these things, and so he's been a mentor and a friend to me over my life, and I just can't say enough about him. He's an amazing person.
Well, so there you were. You worked for him for 10 years. You had this pivotal shift in 1985, which, you know, I think it's interesting. I've had moments in my life where everything shifted, and I could go right back to a place in time where that happened. And so, mm-hmm. how did things progress then? I mean, you were on a spiritual journey at that point. Would you say you weren't spiritual before,
well,
and you became?
No, well, I wouldn't say that. During the 60s, and, you know, this may be a little bit of a controversial subject, but during the 60s, the late 60s, many of us were coming of age. We were 17, 18, 19, 20 years old, whatever, during 68, 69, 70, during the social revolution. And
mm-hmm.
many of us were disillusioned by the course of our fathers, our mothers, our civilization, our culture, and so we started to stand up against things like war and killing people, and, you know, seemingly for no good reason. So the whole protests of the Vietnam War and all of that, I was very just caught up in. And the message of love, peace, and brotherhood is what, you know, really has stayed with me through those years. Well,
uh-huh.
one of the things that happened back then was experimenting with hallucinogenic drugs, not as a way to escape or to just get high, but as a way to try to find God. And that's the controversial part. I mean, we really, you know, there was a lot of experimentation and many people claiming, and even to this day, you can go out there and see that these psychoactive hallucinogens, you know, seem to produce experience, and they certainly did for me, of going into higher levels of consciousness and accessing. And many of us did that without guidance and without a true understanding of what was going on, and so it was like rushing in where angels don't go, way before we were ready for that information. So, but nevertheless, I was impacted by all of that, and that, so prior to stopping the use of alcohol and any other drugs, I always had a sense of spirituality and a deep thirst for those things. You know, they say that alcoholics drink because they're thirsty, not for the physical thirst, but the thirst of being intoxicated with spirituality. So the word spirits is, you know, this the word that can mean two things. It can mean alcohol, or it can mean the highest religious experience that you can have. In the Latin, the spiritus, forget the rest of that word, but it's, so that's an interesting thing. So we were drinking back then and using those things because there was something in the soul that was thirsty for higher meaning and value. And so that led me on to, so I had a core belief, and interestingly enough, you know, my training as a child was Baptist, and I actually had an experience when I was 13 of coming into a relationship with Jesus Christ through just a simple reach out. I mean, I heard a message being preached from the pulpit about this guy who loved me unconditionally, no matter what. And I just, something in me responded to that and walked that aisle and did that acceptance thing. And, you know, the problem with that was I got that salvation experience, if you want to call it that, or that religious experience very early. But then no one, my parents, no one else really knew how to give me the milk that I needed to grow after that. And my father had a drinking problem, and there was a lot of upset in the family. But nevertheless, the experience happened and set the stage for my life, really, this relationship with Christ. Now, obviously, I understood Christ in the traditional ways that, you know, the religions about him, and that was what I was weaned on, and whatever milk I did get, a lot of it didn't make sense to me, and particularly, you know, just a lot of it, so I'm not going to get too far off into that, but that set the stage, and when I quit drinking and everything, that's what was there at the core, this this belief in God, this belief in Jesus. And after that, interestingly enough, between like 1985 and 2000 probably, there was a lot of changes. I wanted to be rid of traditional Christianity. I wanted to be rid of religion. To see the results of, you know, the so-called holy wars that have been fought and all this stuff. And I said, well, wait a minute, that's unholy. That's not holy. So, you know, I just went off, and I actually tried to be rid of my religion. And guess what? I found out that that's impossible. Can I depart from a minute? I read something this morning that I'd like to read, if that's okay, about this matter.
Sure.
You know, people, and this ties into my effort to try to be rid of religion. Many of the things in the stories didn't make sense to me. I mean, how could a God, you know, say, don't kill, and then tell his chosen people to go out and kill some other people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we want you to go kill these. So we don't kill, but we want you to go kill these people. So I said, well, that guy would have to have been a schizophrenic, you know, so... And that just didn't make sense to me, a lot of the stories, because I was serious about my inquiry. I was serious about wanting to know. And when I read and studied what we had at that time, much of it didn't make sense. But what else did I have? So I didn't have anything, so I said, well, I'm just going to get rid of all of this and start over. But I found out I couldn't, and I'll read something here. It says, man... This is in paper in the Urantia book, in paper 92, The Later Evolution of Religion. I'm just going to read the first paragraph. Man possessed a religion of natural origin as a part of his evolutionary experience long before any systematic revelations were made on Urantia. But this religion of natural origin was, in itself, the product of man's superanimal endowments. Evolutionary religion arose slowly throughout the millenniums of mankind's experiential career through the ministry of the following influences operating within and impinging upon savage, barbarian, and civilized man. So what that says is it's instinctual. Religion is an instinct primarily. And I can, you know, the word religion actually means the same. It comes from the root word ligier, the French ligere, meaning the same root as ligament. So true religion really is ligament, which binds us to one another. So it's a binding, like ligament that holds muscle to bone, in the sense of man's relationship with Source or God, our Father, it's a binding force in us. So it's hardwired. We can't be rid of it. You know, that just really means a lot to me, that people want to argue about religion, but really religion in the truest sense of the word, it means to bind together again. And so the way I see that, as we are one family and we are bound together by our common Father in heaven, and that relationship. So we are truly one family.
Well, I love that.
Wow. Did I say all that?
Yeah, you did, and I'm glad you went there because so often we talk about religion. I think I was just sharing the story with Joanne, my assistant and my dear friend, yesterday. We worked together about one of the greatest outreach experiences I ever had with the Arantia book was at the Wild Goose Festival when a man came up to me, and he's about my age. I'm 59. He's probably that same age as me. And he started talking to me about how his thirst for God led him, you know, very sincerely, in all sincerity. He was always a deeply religious person, went to seminary, ran smack up against dogma that he couldn't reconcile, mm-hmm. and as a result ended up an atheist. And I was able to give him answers. He had questions. He had real, sincere questions about God that in seminary they couldn't answer to his satisfaction. And, in fact, it actually turned him off. The answers they did offer were so not what his concept was of God that he rejected God instead of the answer. And it always amazes me that, you know, even people who are deeply spiritual get confused about the difference between God, the reality of the glorious Heavenly Father, and man's ideas about God, which are,
yes.
you know, as imperfect as man is. And they end up throwing out God with the religion because they can't reconcile the issue. And when I answered his questions, he just one after another, well, what does it say about this? Well, what does it say about that? And he said, I really want this book. I said, I know you need to have it. And I said, there's a book card in your packet that you got when you registered for it. There's a card for a free book. He said, I'm going to go get it right now. Well, and I asked him, why are you here at this religious festival? He said, I'm here with my wife. So in a little while, his wife comes back with a card, with two cards, and she just smiles really big. She said, you know the man that you were just talking to who is an atheist? And I said, yeah. She said, that's my husband, and we both want the book. And she gave me two cards, and I gave her two books. And it was nice. It was so gratifying to think now someone who, you know, maybe lost faith in religions, per se, and it's not that, you know, and I like that you brought up that they're imperfect, so we can't fault religions. They're evolving.
No.
You know, we have to honor them because that evolution has to take place, and it's a real thing. And
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm glad you said something. That's great.
So how did you come across the Urantia book? Were you...
I was hoping that was going to be your next question. it ties right in. I during that period in the late 60s, early 70s, and I think, you know, I know a lot of people who were presented the book in the 70s. And, I mean, I too was presented the book. And it was during a time in my life when I was doing some pretty serious, let's call it experimentation, and with some of those chemicals, but it was a serious inquiry, a search for higher meanings. And somebody gave me the book. I don't even remember who it was. I was living in Austin, and somebody in that period, like 1970, probably 3 or 4, gave me the book. It immediately got my attention, and I read it intermittently, but I was nowhere near ready for it.
Mm.
And moved on. My life was, I was in the throes of, beginning to be in the throes of addiction. And so it wasn't something I could digest at that point, but that's where it was first introduced. And the second time it was introduced was from a dear friend of mine who has similar background experience. I knew him from the 60s and 70s. We've stayed connected over all these years. And he sent me the book or he sent the book to my wife when I was incarcerated.
Wow.
And Michael Gillespie. I'll say his name. I don't think he'll be mad.
Michael
has been a student of the book since the 70s, and when he found out that this had happened to me, the accusation and being incarcerated, he sent the book to my wife, and she tried to get the book into me, and they refused the book. They wouldn't let me have the book for some reason. I don't know. That's different now, but for whatever reasons, I couldn't get the book. So my wife started sending me the papers in the mail, and she asked me, "What do you want me to send first?" And I said, "Well, and you know, I want to get to the fruit before I do the hard work of actually the preliminaries." So I said, "Send me the teachings, you know, the life and teachings." So she, because she had sent me the content, the table contents, and asked me what I wanted to read next. So she sent me the life and teachings, a few papers at a time, and they let those in. And then I began to study those and actually to begin to share them with others. And this is a really involved story. So that's, I want to stop right there because that's how it was reintroduced into my life. I don't know where we want to go in this conversation from there, but I can tell you that that reintroduction into the book saved my life in there. Let's just say it that way.
Well, I just think that's great. I mean, you know, I found the book because of prison ministry. I don't know if you knew that, but I wasn't in jail myself, but my first husband, who died in 1982, was in jail. And my great friends, Buck and Arlene Weimer, were doing ministry within the prison. He found the book because of them, and I was praying very fervently for answers to spiritual questions that I had, and he gave me the book. So, you know, whenever somebody does prison ministry, they're not just affecting the person that's in jail or incarcerated. They're affecting everybody that person knows in a way, and I think that's really important to remember. And so you've had this. So maybe it's a great time then to tell your story, how you found yourself there, and then how the book played a role. And I want to mention also, we've had Michael Gillespie on the show. Michael is.
Have you? Oh, Michael, yeah.
Yes. Michael's been on the show.
He and I grew up together.
Wow.
We grew up together, in the 60s and 70s, and that's we were both in that same framework of, you know, exploring the social consciousness, the social revolution.
Yes.
That was happening all over the world, really, and we were just in the middle of it as
Michael's
teenagers,
a journalist,
you know,
he's very courageous. I mean, he writes amazingly courageous articles about the plight of the Palestinians and the Middle East. He's
really quite a
great soul.
Right.
So go ahead.
I love Michael.
And maybe, me too.
Okay. Well,
here's a shout out to Michael.
During the after I got sober and in 85, you know, and then in 1990 went to work for John. Of course, John's work was all about relationships and intimacy issues and how our family of origin and how those early years set stages for the way we live our lives. And John used to say, well, it's not a matter of some families being dysfunctional. All families are to some degree dysfunctional, and depending on the level of dysfunction in the family of origin will sort of lead one down certain paths. And so mine went down the path that it did, and there's no blame. It's not a blame game. It's a name game. So as I began to explore my family of origin and how did I become an addict from somebody that was just an innocent child who was trying to find God, really. How did it go from there to becoming an addict? So you know, I had to begin to explore the roots of those issues in my sobriety so that I could, part of the program of AA is to do fearless moral inventories where you go back and search out the flaws in our character and how we got those, how we developed those. And what I started to learn was that my character flaws were all rooted in my instinctual drives for sex, society, and money. A security, let's say, let's call it. My desires for sex, security, and society. So sex meaning a broad term for relationship and all that entails the relationship between a man and a woman or a woman and a woman or a man and a man. I don't care. I'm not really, you know, worried about that part of it, but just the sex relationship, let's call it. And then security meaning how are we going to get our needs met? And then the social aspect, you know, how do we all need approval. We all need approval. So my character flaws were rooted in those instinctual drives running rampant. In other words, no amount of sex or love was going to be enough because of an original wound inside of me that didn't get met or a need originally that didn't get met. Nobody's fault. That's just the way it was. It manifested in that no amount of money is ever going to make me feel secure. So, but to feel secure is an instinctual drive, and it must be met. And then no amount of approval from other people was going to be enough. I mean, when I first got sober, you could line 50 people up on a wall, and 49 of them like me, and one doesn't, and you will find me over flittering around the one who doesn't like me to try to make sure that he comes on board, right? And, you know, that's a defect. That's like, forget him. Go hang out with the 49, right?
Right.
But I had to learn that need for approval was rooted in a deep need that didn't get met in childhood. So, and nobody's fault, again. I really want to make that clear that this is not about blaming anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just what happened. And maybe I came into the world more sensitive to some these things than other people. Maybe there's some genetic predispositions to this. But they still don't fully understand it. But we do know that there's a way out. So as I began to find these areas in my life, then I began to, after about 5 years of that, I began to get my brain out of hock, as they say. And then probably 5 years is when I really started to work on my mind. I mean, my mind was the first 5 years, and then began the work in my emotional life and my spiritual life. So there's a progress from get your brains out of hock, get your emotions straightened out. Then you can begin to work on your spiritual life. Now, interestingly enough, there's a paradox here because from day one in AA, they tell you to get a relationship with God. So you start dealing with the spiritual right from the get-go, and it prefaces everything else. That's how you get your brain out of hock. It's with the help of God. So you can't ever say that it's this, this, and this, but I guess the progress is that, you know, when you start to work on your spiritual, that's when I started looking into Eastern religions. I started looking, and I became an agnostic. I tried to be an atheist. I tried to be an Eastern meditator. I tried to be this and that and the other all through these. I studied Joseph Campbell, who's the great mythologist, and I really got caught up in his work, and so there's been a lot of exploration over my time since then, and even now I continue to explore these things. So where I was going with that is that, you know, one of the areas that I was very messed up in was the sex relationship, the male-female relationship. I'm heterosexual, so I was having a lot of challenges with having an intimate relationship with a woman. And I just never had grown up, really. And those early relationships in the 60s and 70s and on through all the way up to 85, those were not, I was married a couple of times during that period, and those weren't marriages. Those were hostage situations.
Huh.
Where we literally emotionally took each other hostage. And I would choose women who, and this goes back to some very deep stuff, that I would choose women that were had this, some of the same problems as my mother. I mean, it's uncanny how I could line 50 women up and go find the ones that have the problems that fit, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's uncanny. But as
it feels familial,
I
think. That's why we do that. It feels familial to us. It feels like something like our family. It feels like family. But go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have unconscious
absolutely.
Radar.
Well, anyway.
Yeah.
No, yeah, absolutely. It is radar. It's hardwired, and we're going to go find the one that has the issues so that we can finish them. See?
Yeah.
We're trying to finish.
Work them through.
Yeah.
And so we can finish them. Well, one of those marriages was to a woman who was, you know, I was getting better. I was choosing them that had less of those issues. And, I mean, I had my own issues. So I was choosing women that would be at my level of, you know, mental, emotional, and spiritual development. We don't choose. We choose people at our own level and to be with. And so that's, you know, that's my opinion. But anyway, in this marriage, it was... It just didn't work out. It was rooted in the wrong areas. I mean, it was a very, you know, women want intimacy, and then that could lead to sex, maybe. Okay, maybe not. Sometimes it's just the intimacy.
Uh-huh.
Men, or me, I don't know about all men, but I know about me. I have sex and then I feel intimate. See,
huh.
So I have it backwards. Really, I had to learn how to have intimacy that doesn't have anything to do with sex. I'm getting pretty personal here, so if that's okay. But I, at any rate, I had this marriage going on that was rooted in the wrong way. I mean, it started in a very powerful sexual way, and then we tried to be friends, right? See,
yeah.
So that's what
I think
a lot
that
of
happens
do
a lot,
we,
Matthew.
I think our Heavenly Father wants us to learn to be friends first, and for me, I mean, I know He wants me. That's my lesson: is learn to be friends first. Then maybe that might develop into intimacy, and then that intimacy could, on occasion, result in sex. Right?
Right.
I had it all backwards, man. Give me the sex first. Then maybe we can have some intimacy and be friends later. Right?
Well, and if we're lucky, most of us get married, or many of us make the commitment during that really wild and crazy infatuation time when we're having sex. And then we're married. And then we have to start to get to know the person. And to find out whether we have goals in common, whether we have similar or compatible coping mechanisms, or all these things that, you know, we generally learn down the road in our relationship. And if we get committed, we get married during the phase where we're infatuated, we don't really know who we're marrying.
That's absolutely right. And you bring up a good point, because... You know, you said try to find out later if our goals are similar or the same. Instead of me, what I've learned is to figure out who I am and where I'm going, where I want to go, and then find out if there's somebody who has the same idea. And you know, then they. But what I always did was, okay. Who wants to go? And the question was, well, where are we going? Where are you going? Well, I don't really know, but let's go together.
Well, I
you
think
know, so it was again, it's backwards, right? So.
Well, yeah, and I think you're bringing up anyway. A very good point, and just for the sake of our listeners, so they understand, it was a relationship that you fell into. that led you to this most horrible place. So.
Right. What happened there was, you want me to get into that? The marriage lasted about 10 years, and she had a child and before I married her, and I made some very bad decisions. Again, it was my pattern of, fall in love and then try to be friends later. Well, we did all that, and she had a child, and I really have to be honest here. She was married also, and then we met, and I was coming out of another relationship, and I met her, and we had that chemistry boing where you just go out of your gourd and I'm just overamped there, and so we start seeing each other against my own values. I mean, I'm going in the face of my own values. Now, was it sinful? I wouldn't say it was sinful, but it was definitely evil in the sense of I was messing around in a territory that I didn't fully, my values didn't match that. But I'm not going to go so far as to say that was a conscious rebellion against God. I wasn't doing that. I was trying to learn about, trying to have a friend, a girlfriend, the deepest instinct, to have a partner. Mm-hmm. And the problem was she already had a partner, but their marriage was falling apart, and she had a child in the middle of this. So I hear, enter me, then we fall for each other. I'm coming out of another relationship.
And you also had children.
I had two sons from a previous marriage, right? And so, let's just blend. Let's just, and so here I pull, and that her son was 1 year old. He was just one. And so enter me, and I come in there and pull them out of that marriage. Now, did I consciously say, I'm going to wake up this morning and I'm going to go pull them out of that marriage? No, it wasn't like that. It was like a process, and I didn't have any idea really what that young one-year-old child might be experiencing, right? So I raised him as my own son when they moved. We all moved in together, and we stayed together for 10 years, and we were sober, and we were consciously trying to put it all together and be good people, and I took him to Boy Scouts. I took him, did all the same things with him. My sons were 6 or 8 years older than him, so, they were 7 and 9, and he was 1, so I've raised him from the time he was 2, which is when they moved in, to when he was 9, so we said he was 7 years, and then the marriage just fell apart, and I was his dad. I mean, he called me daddy. But he probably had, who knows what all he had going on. He had some sexual confusion about, he thought he might be gay, and he was struggling with that. That actually came out in the trial. I didn't even really know that he had come forward about that to people. But the point was, what happened was she took him and moved out, and he's my stepson, right? And then we got a divorce. And I was seeing him. He would come over and visit with me and the boys, my boys, and because it was like he was my son. I mean, I'd raised him from the time he was 2 till he was 9, doing all the things, taking him to school, waking up in the middle of the night, taking care of him, teaching him Little League, playing ball, doing all the things that dads and their sons do. And so I was trying, and I was working for Bradshaw during all this time, speaking out against sexual abuse. Well, his mother decided that after she moved that I started dating again, and when she found out I was dating, this isn't a blame game again, but this is what happened. She decided that he couldn't come see me anymore, and so then they moved 90 miles away, and I was in a dilemma. What am I going to do? I have no legal rights to fight for being able to see him. We're divorced. He's not my son legally. She said no, he can't come. So we were cut off from each other. And I had to learn to let go.
That's so tragic.
Mm-hmm. Very tragic. I mean, I was able to write to him for a while, and those letters all came out in the court where he wrote to me, and I wrote to him, and we were very, very much, you know, convinced that we were going to be able to resume our relationship at some point, but it just didn't happen, and I had to let go. I could not continue to, because it always ended up in conflict between me and his mother, and his mother and him. He would pick all that up. I just decided I've got to let this go. And I did let it go, and then we had no contact for 6 years. And then when he was 14, I got a knock on my door from the CPS, and he had made up the story. And again, I want to just make a presumption here that because of his budding sexuality and his confusion over his sexual identity, he created this story that I had abused him. Perhaps he was angry at me and he felt abandoned. And you know what? Rightfully, he felt that way. I mean, because...
Well, he was too young to understand the dynamics that were separating
yes,
you.
Yes, and... So, but it absolutely, his accusation absolutely did not happen. There was, you know, just, it was just horrible. It was a horrible. So that was the beginning of a journey, a ride, a part of my life that is the hardest thing that I've ever experienced. You started off the program with talking about being falsely accused. Bearing false witness is a horrible crime. Now, again, I don't think Heavenly Father holds him accountable in the area of a sinful act. I don't think he woke up and said, I'm going to rebel against God today and make a false accusation. Mm-hmm. It didn't happen that way. So this wasn't a conscious effort at hurting somebody. He was trying to deal with his own pain. And make sense of his own sexuality. And perhaps this story helped him. Well, I'm this way because somebody messed me up. And who knows what really happened. Maybe somebody did abuse him. I don't have any idea. So that was the beginning of I got charged. First I went down and was interviewed by the CPS. I will tell all listeners that are listening, if this ever happens to anybody, do not go to the CPS interview without an attorney. Do not do that.
That's Child Protective Custody, right? When you say CPS,
yes,
Child Protective Services. Right.
Yeah, they're the ones that got a hold of the story and was reported to them. And the area that this – let me talk a little bit about how the accusation came up. There was a speaker who was an ex-convict. They had moved to a rural town in Texas, my ex-wife and her son. And this convict was on the speaking schedule touring these middle schools and making these talks in front of these middle school students about these issues of their budding sexuality. I mean, I'm just amazed that in rural Texas they allow this. But this ex-convict actually got up on the stage and this all came out in court, was asking these students to stand up if they were a virgin.
Gee.
Can you imagine being 13 or 14 years old and being asked to stand up if you're a virgin? And what if you're not? Then you have to sit down and be ostracized from the rest of your...
Right.
Or you're forced into a lie, right? You're forced to lie. And then he asked if anybody had anything that had happened to them inappropriately that they wanted that now was the time to come forward. And he was giving t-shirts and shoes and socks and books, giving those things away to people who came forward. I'm starting to feel the energy, the moral outrage of that. That's not directed at anybody in particular, but just the fact that that, you know, that's just so unintelligent. And it's morally outrageous to me that they would put these young children in a position like that. Well, this young boy was fairly lower middle class, probably, and new shoes. You remember when all the teenagers were freaking, you know, the shoes were the thing? I mean, the fancy shoes, the name brand shoes and all of that. Well, this kid was going to shoes with duct tape on his tennis shoes. And
this
all
is your stepson?
They were all torn up. Yes.
Your
yes.
stepson,
and
yes.
when he saw those new shoes, they looked pretty attractive. Now, again, I'm speculating, okay, but this is just what happened. Here's somebody up there on the stage giving gifts away to people who bring forth stories. Well, he stood up and went up there and gave them a story, and that's when this all started. They went to his mother, and he went to the guy, and they did not tell the school authorities. They went to the mother first. Well, it should have gone straight to the school authorities, right, first.
Right.
But they went to the mother, and she didn't believe it. But, you know, they did some investigation, and then eventually it got before CPS, and the CPS is, do not go down and talk to those folks, because they have an agenda. The agenda is that the child does not lie, does not ever lie. That's their agenda. And they will take whatever you say and twist it and use it against you. So, and they tell you that. So I was being videotaped and audiotaped without my permission, without knowing I was during that
CPS interview.
Without
your knowledge, right.
Yes, yes, they videotaped me, and I was terrified. I was terrified, and my life had become... I was almost hospitalized. I went to several doctors. The depression. I went to this place. This is what I'm talking about being falsely accused of something horrendous like this. I went to a place, an animal place inside of me that began to weep, and I would weep for hours, and my wife could do nothing about it except just hold me while I wept. Mm. It was the lowest, and they took me to the doctor, and they almost hospitalized me, but she tried some different things and got me on some antidepressants and some anxiety medications that I, you know, being a drug user from the past, I thought, oh, I like these, but they did help, you know, and I didn't get addicted, luckily, again. But I was taking them all the way up to being the day of the trial. So that's kind of the background. And, you know, it did come to trial. I was out on bond for a year and a half. I had to go down and urinate once a week in a jar. I couldn't go. I couldn't see my grandkids. I couldn't see be around an elementary school. I couldn't have a computer during that year and a half. I couldn't... you know, if I was found within a certain distance of young children at play in a park or something, it was horrible. Horrible. I couldn't hug my own children, not my own grandchildren. I couldn't be with them. I couldn't see them. Nothing. So for a year and a half, I was on bond, and I did that and paid them for that urinalysis every week. That's one of their money-making deals there. So,
were you able to work or hold a job during that time?
I did have a job, and yes, I had a career, and I'm self-employed, and I was so they allowed me to have a computer access at my job. And I remember going and meeting with a client one time who had her child at work with her, and here I am in my business, and there's a child, and I'm not supposed to be around children. It was just you can imagine the anxiety that I felt I mean, how are you going to walk down the street without being close to a child at some point? So
well, you know,
I
this,
was on.
This,
I was.
This touches on something for me, and that is, you know, the disillusionment of believing. I mean, I can imagine you've strongly warned us, don't go there without an attorney. And now we're talking about the rule of law, and we're talking about people who are trained to navigate legal systems and people who are trained to protect you from injustice. Really, that's what they do. That's why you would go there with one. But you think in your heart somewhere, and I think this has been said by so many people who have been falsely accused of something, they have faith in the system somehow, that it's going to work for them, that the truth is going to come out, and they'll be, you know. But in the meantime, and what you've pointed out just now about how you spent a year and a half with all of these liberties taken away, you are, in fact, not considered innocent until proven guilty.
No.
Quite the opposite.
I deal with that quite extensively in my book. And the idea that somebody can be accused of a crime with no evidence whatsoever and actually be convicted of that crime just based on the words of one person with another against another is ludicrous. It's against Jesus, our master, said, let there be two or more witnesses to establish a thing. And
right.
So, and Paul said that, and it's back in, further back in the, Moses said it. Moses, Paul, and Jesus, all three said, let there be two or more witnesses to establish a thing. Those were powerful words.
Yeah.
Our rule of law in this country, and probably it's worse in others, is that somebody can accuse you of a crime and they can lock you up based on just the words of somebody. No evidence. In fact, all the evidence pointed against it. But here's the jury. They're coming in there. They're terrified of making a mistake. They shouldn't ever even be put in that position in the first place. I don't know what the answer is totally. I think these type of crimes that actually do happen should be investigated and dealt with in separate, especially when you're going to bring a 12, 13-year-old kid child into a courtroom and ask them to stand up there and testify.
Mm-hmm.
Good Lord. I mean, and so there's tons of stuff that went on there. So I was out on bond for a year and a half. That's when I went through all the emotional turmoil and almost was hospitalized. And then I was seeing a therapist that was helping me to get through it. And I was taking these Xanax, this anti-anxiety medication, which is really, you know, a powerful drug. And
yes, it is.
I took it right up to the day of court. And the court was a 3-day fiasco of I'm the one that had all the witnesses to attest to my character. We had 30 some odd letters to the grand jury prior to all of this, before they actually indicted me, attesting to my character. I had a letter from John Bradshaw, a powerful letter from John, attesting to my character. And here's a man speaking. I mean, here's what happens. And again, people, listen to this. The grand jury rubber stamps these cases. They do not read the letters. They do not look at the evidence or lack of. They rubber stamp it.
I want to interject something right here, too. From reading your book, I know that you had also undergone a psychological profile, which you basically passed with flying colors, and you had undergone a polygraph, which basically exonerated you as innocent, and neither of these things were allowed to be seen by the grand jury,
yes, exactly right, by the grand jury or by the jury that was they say it's up to them. They wanted me to take a polygraph, and they wanted me to take their polygraph. Now, here's another point to people: do not take the police's polygraph. Whatever polygraph they offer you, don't take it. Go get your own. Get an attorney. If this ever happens to you, man, God, just hope that it never does, but it can and does happen to people.
Mm-hmm.
I, to this day, and this has been how many years ago? 2006. I mean, this is 8 years later. I do. If I go into a public restroom and there's a child in there and no adults, I walk out.
Huh.
I can't do it. The kids can say stuff. Kids can make stories up. They do lie about this. They do. Whether
you
it's
about disillusionment, the reality
it is
that
interesting.
Kids do lie, and that kids can go down that path. People go down that path. They do lie. They do say things, and it's the tangled web, right? Once you start, you don't know how to get back out, and so you go deeper in.
Exactly. Exactly right. And the prosecutors, they want a conviction. The prosecutors, they do not care about truth. They do not.
Well, and that's really the critical thing here, in my opinion, and in my reading, is that the real tragedy of what our justice system has become is not about getting to truth, not about really getting to justice. It's really
about
this battle between the prosecution and the defense.
Almost a spectator sport. Yeah, it's like who'll win. It's like a spectator sport. It's who'll win. The winner is what matters the most. And, of course, you have a person's life hanging in the balance. And I just want to point out that, you know, in the old days, right, if you didn't like what a guy did, you sent a bunch of other guys over to beat him up and burn his house down. You know, at least the legal system, as flawed as it is much better than that. It's much better than... you know, what they used to do in the old days when the king just decided you were guilty and that was it, you know.
Yeah.
Off with his head. And we see, you know, the whole spectrum even existing right now on this world today. And so, you know, our system, even as flawed as it is still better than what we had 100 years ago or 200 years ago.
Go ahead.
I just was going to say, Andre's been trying to get a word in edgewise.
Well,
we
have been on the air for an hour, so let's just station identify and say, this is Blog Talk Radio, the Cosmic Citizen, and we're on the air with Wayland Matthew Fox. And what I wanted to say, Matthew, is what a lot of people don't understand, and I don't know how true this is of, say, all men in American or Canadian society, but I know that, you know, as a male, when I'm anywhere around children and there's any possibility, say, of, you know, hugging or, you know, any contact like that, what has happened in the media gives me pause to think, is this something I really want to do in this context? I will not do this, you know, in general, as a rule. I will not hug a child alone with that child. I will not, you know, I mean, and that is so different from the way I grew up. I grew up with adults hugging and, you know, really being very, very close with kids and never having to think about this. And what people don't realize is that this has to be thought about. It has to be thought about. You may say, well, wait a minute. You know, if you've got nothing to worry about, then you don't have to worry about that at all. And the answer to that is no. No, that's entirely a naive point of view. There are so many people that in order, and this is actually a good thing in some ways. There were so many children, okay, that were never listened to at one point, that the pendulum has swung the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And now it is always listen to the child. It's even always believe the child. And the unfortunate thing about all of that is that children don't always get it right. Children don't always tell the truth. And if you're in that kind of a situation, then just out of pure self-protection in some cases, especially, I mean, with strangers' children, there's no way you want this to happen. I have heard too many horror stories like the one that you're talking about that happened to you, Matthew. And as a result of my contact with people and informal counseling that I do with people, I've heard too many horror stories about this.
Well, and and you were a teacher working with kids who were either in trouble or having learning disabilities. So you were working in the school system for several years dealing with teenage kids. So you were especially vulnerable. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
well, yeah, that's another area, you know, the relationships that are happening between teachers and their students and everything. It's just we're in a context now where the walls are glass. So there's no you do have to be conscious but it shouldn't govern everything. You should be able to openly hug your grandchildren or any child with the other adults around. But I'm paranoid about it. I just am. And I don't want to be, but it's just part of what I have to live with, and hopefully eventually it'll be gone in this world or the next. But,
so,
you know, go ahead.
Well, the prosecutors then are like hell-bent to prove their case against you. They have really no evidence. What did they use?
Here's
did
the
they
thing.
Use emotional? Did they play on that emotional card more than anything?
Well, they use everything though. Let's talk a little bit more about that, because in all of the investigations of the prosecutor and and my attorney, I had when I was 14. Interestingly enough, there's two instances. When I was 14, I was molested by. I was picked up by this. I had a paper route. I was throwing papers, and it was freezing morning one morning, and this guy picked me up to give me a ride home after I'd finished my papers, because I had to walk otherwise, and it was freezing outside. So I said, oh, sure, thank you. Well, he was a molester. He reached over, and he tried to molest me and terrified me, and I got out of the car and ran home. Well, now, guess what? They bring that up in court.
Oh, wow.
Because the idea is that people who are molested grow up to be molesters, right?
Right.
And then another time, it happened another time later in my life where I was 17 and had a guy that, you know, and again, coming out of the family that I came out of, there was this real deep lack of I don't want to get too far into this because this is all psychological, mental, emotional stuff. So I had this deep, deep need to be approved of and appreciated and my gifts. And so when I graduated from high school, I took a job and I was working in a display area of a department store, and the guy that managed that was a homosexual. And I was so naive I didn't know that was his agenda. I just didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
He told me how wonderful I was, how beautiful I was, how my art was off the chart good. And he taught me how to design these beautiful flowing things in the department store. And he wanted something in return. And then I got caught in a trick bag. I didn't know, and so that happened. He abused me. He took advantage of me. And that came out in court. So, again,
any of the intimate information that you share between husband and wife.
All that comes out in court.
Yeah.
All of it. Well, let me tell you this. What they do is they'll have a motion, they'll have a meeting in private quarters. It's the prosecutor, the defense attorney, and the judge. And they will sit and decide what is allowed in and what isn't. And so some of that stuff was supposedly not supposed to come into the courtroom about, like you're talking about, private things between a man and his wife. What they do in bed together is not supposed to be brought out. But then when you have a judge who is, guys, I mean, we could talk about this for days, but the judge literally fell asleep on the bench. It was recognized by a number of people in the audience. The judge fell asleep during the proceedings. He was a visiting judge, a conservative, cigar-smoking, and I'm not attacking his politics, but he was a
good old
basically,
boy.
You know, very prosecutor-friendly, let's say it that way.
Wasn't he a temporary judge with whom he had all the agreements made, and then when it came down to the trial, he wasn't present.
Right, he was not present. And he knew what the agreements were, but being pro-prosecutor, he claimed that my attorney opened the door to that information that was supposedly held. They call it held in limine. That it was held in limine, that it was not allowed in court. But unless they say somebody opens the door to the evidence, like in my case, it was held in limine for my protection so that jurors won't be prejudiced. Well, the appellate court ruled that that was completely out of line, that that judge had no business bringing that information about our sexual things that we did together, my wife and I, ex-wife and I, and so I'll just say it. I mean, it involved. I'm not gonna say it. It's nobody's business. I'm sorry. It was just some intimate things that we were playfully doing in the bed and in bedroom. So I hope I'm not being too personal here, but. They take that information and twist it and turned me into being some kind of freak, right?
Right.
Just about 99% of the American and world population into freaks. If anybody anybody's sexual conduct was brought under scrutiny like that,
Everybody
would
be
looking.
Right.
Yes, correct.
Well,
yeah,
and there's
a
reason for the sanctity of marriage, and there's a reason for the sanctity of privacy and all of this, and I think your point is that when you find yourself in this situation, all bets are off. Everything is open to be exposed and misunderstood and twisted and made and perverted for a different, I think the Urantia book says the shadow of a hare's turning, twisted for an untrue purpose. This constitutes falseness. Mm-hmm. And, so the point is that, a lot of improprieties went on, but in the meantime, you were actually convicted and sentenced because of these improprieties. However, on the other hand, you were able to maybe mount an appeal based on those. But in the meantime, find yourself being convicted of a horrible crime and sentenced. What were you sentenced to?
10 years. 10 years.
Ten years.
It had a 2 to 20 range. Here's what happened in that instance. The jury was deadlocked after the first day of deliberation. They were deadlocked, and they sent out a request to hear some additional, to read the transcript of testimony that had previously taken place. And it had to do with where the accuser said certain things happened. And there was discrepancy in some areas where he said different things in both the pre-trial hearings with the CPS and with, in other words, his story changed several times. And the jury became deadlocked because of those issues. And the next day, we came back, and the jury went into deliberation, and they came, and they, at the end of the day, were deadlocked again. And they came out, and the judge ordered, and he did an Allen charge. That is a, what it is a pep talk to tell the jury that they have a constitutional responsibility
duty?
To come to a decision. Huh?
Yeah.
To come to a decision. Yeah, a duty, a responsibility and a duty to come to a decision. And he sent them back into deliberation after that Allen charge. It's called an Allen charge. It's a pep talk. And it doesn't mean anything, but they don't know that. They don't have to come to a decision. They can be deadlocked and say, we can't reach a decision. Sorry. You know, and then he would have to order the trial, deadlocked, and they would either have to retry it,
or
drop the charges.
Mistrial, yeah. So they didn't do any of that. They went back in. Now, check this out. This was happening 10 days before Christmas. So now you've got jurors sitting in there, and they, guess what? They want to go shopping.
They want to go home. How long has this gone on?
They have social obligations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. And so they don't want to come back the next day because the judge is going to make them come back if they don't come to a decision today. So at the end of the day, end of that day, they reached a decision of guilty.
Mm.
And then the next day, I had to come for sentencing. And the next day, they gave me 10 years. In prison, and when they found me guilty, they escorted me over into the jail. I turned around and looked at all the people that were there supporting me, and there were many, many hundreds of people had come to my aid in this whole thing. We had to mortgage our house. We lost everything income-wise to have to give to all the attorneys. Which is another subject I would like to touch base on the choosing of an attorney when I was in the process of choosing an attorney. But just to finish that line of thought, I looked over at everybody in the court when they said guilty, and I had taken those Xanax that day, so I was in a place where, so what next? It's like
the gravity
didn't hit me at that.
Right.
No, it did not. I looked around at everybody, and I gave everybody in the room the thumbs up. And they took me into the jail. And I didn't see daylight for 17 months. Literally, after that, I did not see the sunshine.
Wow.
I was in a dungeon. I lost all sense of space and time and everything in there during that 17 months. Now, obviously, after a while, I began to reorient myself to that place. But the backing up,
which is a hell of a thing to have to reorient yourself to.
Right.
Well,
you can adapt to anything, but adapting to that, the changes that go internally, psychologically, how demoralizing it is, few people can even imagine.
How cruel. And
Can I ask a question? Am I on to one, or how long am I on?
Well,
o'clock Central.
40 minutes. We have 40 minutes. Maybe.
Okay, good, because there's some important things I want to cover. And I could talk about this for days, guys, but I mean, I just, there's some important things that I want to, it's a pleasure to be able to do this, particularly in the sense I want to get into the solution of how to survive something like this, or what my experience is of how I survived this
actually
thrived. Actually thrived in this environment. But before I go there, I want to talk about the choosing of an attorney. I was a pretty sharp guy. I was pretty, I'm conscious. I mean, I've been a student of religion and spirituality and sober for 30 years now. And, I study, I read, I try to keep close to God every day of my life. That's part of my recovery. If I don't do that, I mean, I could relapse and go back into that, those old ways. Mm-hmm. I could very easily. So
right.
I have to do this. And now it's a pleasure to do it. I don't think about that old life anymore. But because of all my education, self-taught education, I went to these attorneys. I started interviewing attorneys, and I had three questions. I had one, why are you an attorney? I'm sorry, two main questions. There were other questions, but the two main ones I asked every attorney and really based my decision on their answer was, number one, why are you an attorney?
Why did you want to be an attorney?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that was my question. And you would be surprised at how important that question can be.
Yes.
The second question was, does it matter to you if your client is innocent?
Hmm.
So those were my two questions, my main questions. And I interviewed some top dog lawyers. And one of them told me, the first question, I heard things like, well, I like being in front of a trial jury. It brings me alive when I'm in front of a, you know, I'm more passionate than any other time. So I said to this guy, so you have a vested interest in getting in front of a trial jury?
In going to trial?
Yes. I said, I am not interested in going to trial, sir. Have a nice day.
Yeah.
Right away, he told me what motivates him, what brings him
mm-hmm.
alive. He had mm-hmm. no idea he told me that. I mean, he had no idea that he was dealing with somebody that understood that people make these kinds of decisions based on what brings them alive. So, you know, so I didn't choose him. Another one told me that an innocent person was his worst nightmare.
Oh, wow.
And this is a top dog lawyer. And he said, because, you know, and again, I can understand that perspective. For instance, if he loses, he's got to live with that. That if he
right.
knew
yeah,
that
the live
person
with
was
putting
innocent.
An innocent person behind bars.
It's not
so
just
I
a game now.
It, but here's the thing. He knew that going in, or if he didn't, he should have, that was going to be happen sometimes, that he wasn't going to win every case, and that he was going to be a part of putting innocent people in jail. He needed to know that. If somebody's going to be an attorney, they need to know that. They're not
mm-hmm.
going to win every case. And probably are going to end up with innocent people going to jail. And there are many innocent people in jail. So finally I got to this attorney that said, well, yeah, it's very important to me if my client's innocent. He said, that just makes me fight harder. Oh, well, that's the right answer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he also said the reason he was attorney because he liked the idea of helping people. He just liked the idea to help people who, because he understood that it's David versus Goliath in the justice system.
People can get in trouble to no fault of their own. They can be falsely accused.
Well,
he understands that.
Right. And David, I'm sorry, Goliath is the system, and they have the resources.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They have all the resources.
Endless.
They have the size.
Endless resources.
They have the size. Yeah, endless. And the mm-hmm. David doesn't. He's got a little slingshot, right?
Right. Right.
And
so
the other thing, that I'm really impacted by with your story and with hundreds of other similar stories of people going up against that Goliath, is that the people
mm-hmm.
working in the prosecutorial system, in the judicial
mm-hmm.
system, are working in this field every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're dealing with hundreds of people going through their doors on a weekly basis, and it's a job, and it's a system that they're completely immersed in. But
half of them are on antidepressants themselves. Half of them or more
are
also
antidepressants. I can imagine,
yes,
because it would be a really hard system to be working in. But my point is that they know it inside and out, and you come into it completely like a
babe
fish
in
out
the
of
wood.
Water.
Yeah.
A babe in the woods.
Yeah.
And we all expect the system to work for us.
Yes.
Well, you pray, you hope
that's why I went down. That's why I went down to the CPS without an attorney. I thought, once they hear my story, once they hear, they'll understand.
I tell the
and
truth,
they'll say, oh, this is
they'll
all
believe me.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I am no longer naive about that. That's absolutely not the case. People are, and God bless all of them. I don't want a system where we don't have those folks in there. And the other thing is they become anesthetized to it.
Yeah.
They have
indifferent.
To. They have to.
And
plus
you always hear police saying, you know, come on down to the station and tell us your side of the story. If you're innocent, you have nothing to hide.
Which can't navigate
those waters.
And it's dishonest. Yeah.
Yeah. You can't navigate those waters by yourself. You need somebody in your corner that knows the system, just what you said, Crystalline. Well, it sounds like to me, Matthew, you went exactly right by finding a good attorney. This guy got you. Was he the one that won on appeal for you?
He is, because, I mean, now that's a good point, a good second segue into this, because how many people, if they lost their case with an attorney, would rehire him for the appeal?
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Right, so it cost me more money. Now, here's what happened. When I got convicted, the attorney needed another $25,000. We didn't have any money. We'd given him all our money. We didn't have any. None. We had no money.
And you had given him $50,000 for the first part.
$50,000 for the first part,
with another
$10,000 in fees and different things that the court costs, and I mean all the things that I had to pay for. So yeah, we spent close to $100,000 altogether. But the $25,000 was his fee for the appeal, and we didn't have any money. So here's what happened. My friends, I mean, I have a huge social network. I'm a social person. I have 900 Facebook connections. I mean, that's a little bit over the top, right? You know, but I am. I'm socially motivated, and I have lots of friends, and lots of just acquaintances. But my friends who knew me and knew that I didn't do this came together with my wife, about seven or eight of them, and met at my home while I was in jail after the conviction and said, what are we going to do? A brilliant friend of mine named Stan Goss is a motivational coach here in Houston area. He got an idea. He said, well, what if we just all sent out an email through our email connections, just asking them for $25 or $50 or $100 or whatever they can afford to go towards a worthy cause. Do you know that these guys raised $22,000 over the next 3 weeks?
Wow. Wonderful.
And they were sending people that I don't even to this day know were sending checks to my wife in the mail, $25, $50, $100, $10. $22,000. We needed $25, and I had an uncle that at the saw that we needed, you know, found out we needed that last, and he just gave the last 25, and we presented
that
to the attorney.
Well, now that's how God works.
It's amazing outpouring of love and people trusting somebody that they, you know, trusting a friend who knows a friend, right? So half these people that donated, a bunch of them knew me. People in my business gave money, people in my connections all over the country, and people I don't know. Just hundreds of donations came in, and I'm still blown away by that. So
that's really one of the beautiful sides of this story.
here you are now. You're going to do a 10-year sentence. Your attorney starts I'm surmising. They raise the money, a 17-month process of appeal. And you know it's going to take some time, so you settle into this very dark place. So that's what I really, you know, we have 30 minutes. I'd love for you to get into how you survived reality and the gravity of the situation you found yourself in. And I do want to add, in case we don't get to say it, that you were completely exonerated and your record expunged. You don't have, you know, other than people's doubt, you know, which will probably always, people will always have doubt.
Always be there.
You don't have, your record was completely expunged. You were exonerated. But, you know, not at this moment you are in that dark place where you're thinking, I'm going to be here for 10 years or whatever. And, you know, I know they're going to appeal, but now you have no faith in the system probably. You know, you're hoping that the appeal will work, but you've lost all faith in the system. How do you survive this situation? And I know you did it with God.
And to add insult to insult to injury, you're also suddenly withdrawing off of the Prozac and Xanax.
Right.
That's where we'll start. So first, I was completely taken off of those medications without any. So I began after 24 hours in there to hallucinate and to withdraw off of those drugs and without any doctor supervision. I was hallucinating. I was out of my mind. I was talking. But the thing about, have you ever heard the term, he's beside himself?
Uh-huh.
You've heard that, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I know what that means. I mean, I literally would watch myself go insane and say all these things, and then I would come back to myself, and I said, you just did that. You're out of your mind. And now, but now I'm watching myself be out of my mind, right? So they took me down. Everybody started complaining about me, yelling in the middle of the night. So they took me down to the medical office, and I thought I was going to get some help. Well, they took me down there, and they, gave me some strong sleeping pill or something, and then they took me back up. I thought they were going to take me someplace better where I was going to be taken care of or something. I mean, I was terrified.
Where you would get some actual medical help.
Right, and they were taking me back to the same place that I was before, and I stopped in the middle of this hall. I said, wait a minute, I can't go back in there. Well, they saw that as resisting arrest. They threw me on the floor, started beating the hell out of me. They handcuffed me behind my back, dragged me into a room, and sprayed pepper spray right in my eye. Now, I've experienced bad things, but I know what, if there were such a place as hell, I went there in that moment. And that was the most horrendous thing that happened to me in there, was they beat the hell out of me, banged my head on the cement floor, and sprayed me with pepper spray, and then they threw me in solitary confinement for 70 days.
Wow.
Oh, goodness.
70 days
this
in solitary confinement.
This is like your first couple of days in there. You're like,
now, this is where it starts. This is where it turns, though. This is where the story turns around, because in the solitary confinement, I had nothing. I was found. Somebody gave me a Bible. I read the entire Bible for in 70 days. I read the entire Bible. And now I didn't read all the he begat, so-and-so begat, so-and-so begat. I skipped that part. But I did read everything. I missed all the begats. I just couldn't deal with it. But it was, I did read the rest of it, every sentence in the Bible. First time I'd ever done that. And what I began to see was this beautiful weaving of story and legend and historical fact in these beautiful stories, some of them just insanely contradictory. But nevertheless, it gave me an understanding of biblical things that I didn't understand before. Finally, when I got out of there, that's when Sandra started sending me the Urantia papers. Well, during that 70 days, I became I said, well, I'm here, and there's absolutely nothing I can do about it.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Have to
so there's
the
a surrender.
So there's a surrender. So that's when I changed from being somebody who was in solitary to exploring solitude. And I read Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, that somebody, that was the other book I had in there. He was the Nazi, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I read that, and I said, well, this guy can do that. I mean, I'm a human being. I can do that. So I started meditating 3-4 hours a day, exercising yoga exercises in my cell. And for 70 days, I did nothing but pray, read the Bible, meditate, and pray for 70 days. And then that produced a habit. That created a habit. So when I got thrown back in the main population after that, oh, by the way, I went to court in there and was inside the jail, where they found me guilty of resisting arrest and sentenced me to the 70 days. I forgot to tell you about that. But that's when I did the 70 days. I got out of there. I watched somebody try to hang themselves. I watched prisoners beat with handcuffs, and I mean, I saw some really horrible things. But I saw somebody get raped. I'm just going over that to give you a juxtaposition of the horror that goes on in there, and the ability to transcend it through getting close to God. So in this prayer and meditation time, when I was thrown back in regular population, I started reading the papers. Sandra was sending them to me. And then I started sharing them with a couple of other prisoners, and then we created a group, and then we started, and they are still in there. And I am still communicating with them through letters, and I send them Urantia stuff, and they have the books, and they're sharing them with other prisoners. And, you know, so this is a thing that just takes off by itself. The Spirit does this. And so, but my point is that I've got this habit of prayer and meditation. And what happened was, in my cell, I had six other people in my particular cell, and there's no privacy. It's just all jail cell, just all bars, and green steel and gray, green and gray. That's it. And orange jumpsuits. After a while, I hated those people at first. They were animals. I mean, they were, every other word was a curse word. They walked around, and they were just hardened people that were at each other's throats all the time. So in my prayer and meditation, because I was a little older, they didn't mess with me too much in the way of hurting me or trying to tempt me to fight or something like that. But they, after a while, when they saw that I was meditating in prayer, I would literally lay in my bunk and pull the blanket up over my head and enter into this meditation practice. And I learned how to meditate. We were carving rubber things out of our sandals that they gave us, and for earplugs. The things that we did to survive in there are pretty amazing. People can be incredibly, incredibly creative when in the position. Your Urantia book talks about the people that went up north evolved faster because they faced danger. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's a similar kind of thing. We were in there and we were faced with horrible conditions, and so our creativity came. So we made earplugs out of our sandals and out of pieces of our sandals so that I could at least block some of the noise out. It wasn't very good, but I learned how to meditate in the midst of that. Mm-hmm. People slamming dominoes, screaming at each other, fighting, yelling, arguing. And after a while, these people began to notice me. And every time I would come out of these meditations and this prayer, the Spirit would this was natural. It wasn't something I chose or decided to do. It's just when you have a length of time with God, you naturally gravitate towards your fellows. You just do. You want to know them, you want to understand them, and you want to help them. These are natural things that are part of our makeup. And when we're close to God, we get restored to that natural place.
And so as I did this, I got to know, I started getting to know these, some of these people. And the hatred that I had for them changed to intolerance. I mean, to tolerance. And so I began to tolerate them. Then as I continued to pray and meditate and move out towards them in an effort of, you know, being there and helping them, I mean, I was writing letters for them and, you know, helping them with their case and helping them, you know, and then they were drawn into me, and I got to know them. Some of these people have stories that are just rend your heart. One of the guys I talked to watched his mother get shot in the face in a convenience store by a robber. He was 15 or something. And, the stories are horrendous. I watched 17-year-old kids go to prison for having a 16-year-old girlfriend having sex with them.
Oh boy.
I watched old folks, grandfathers who maybe had a little drinking problem, and one of them was taking a leak in the bathroom, peeing in the bathroom, and his granddaughter comes in there and he opens the door and he turns around. He's been drinking a little bit, and she sees his penis, and she runs and tells her mother, "Grandpa showed me his penis. He went to jail."
Wow.
So he went to jail for I don't know what the whole story was there, but I know that this man was not an evil man. I know that by getting to know him. Mm-hmm. By getting to know these people, my tolerance changed from tolerance to friendship.
Mm-hmm.
Then as I continue to befriend and understand what motivates these people, it turns to love.
Mm-hmm.
It changes from hate to love. And so I know that the Heavenly Father lives inside of each one of these people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just amazing. I'm getting emotional here, but, I started to do
and
things
how
like...
And how did they respond to you when you began to the process of trying to get over your hostility and move towards friendship and love? How did that...
Well, they understood my hatred. They hated me too at first.
Right.
But then as they watched me do things like, we're going to take up a collection today. Everybody has commissary, right? And most folks, about 75% of them in there, get some kind of commissary. 25% have nothing. So what I started to do was go from cell to cell with a bag. I say, who wants to give something today for the people that don't have anything? Right? And then they would start to throw in little sacks of ramen soup, and I would go around from cell to cell and collect this big bag of goodies, then go give it to the people who didn't get commissary.
And what
right?
did that
and
mean? They didn't get commissary meant that they didn't have anyone on the outside who cared to send them anything or...
Right. They had no money. They lived completely on what the jail people gave them. They had never a
outside.
Chocolate bar.
I
had this one guy, and he would come up. His name was, I called him One Eye. He only had one eye. Well, they all called him One Eye. I won't give his name, but he came up every day. And Mr. Fox, you got a little coffee? He didn't have anything. He would come over, and then I got to know him. And somebody slammed a shovel in the side of his head. He was trying to build a business and be a landscaper. And you know, these stories these guys have are just, as I got to know them, I fell in love with them.
Mm-hmm.
And not all of them were easy to love. Some of them were very difficult to love.
Right. They're so angry.
But we can love them. We just have to see the Christ in them. We have to see
Matthew,
our Father in there. Uh-huh.
I have to share a quote from the Urantia book at this point because it's so poignant to what you've just said. And we've shared this one on the show before, but it bears repeating because it is such a central principle to the Urantia book about learning to love one's fellow human beings. It's from Paper 100, Religion and Human Experience. It's Section 4, Paragraph 6. You cannot truly love your fellows by a mere act of the will. Love is only born of thoroughgoing understanding of your neighbor's motives and sentiments. It is not so important to love all men today as it is that each day you learn to love one more human being. If each day or each week you achieve an understanding of one more of your fellows, and if this is the limit of your ability, then you are certainly socializing and truly spiritualizing your personality. Love is infectious, and when human devotion is intelligent and wise, love is more catching than hate. But only genuine and unselfish love is truly contagious. If each mortal could only become a focus of dynamic affection, this benign virus of love would soon pervade the sentimental emotion stream of humanity to such an extent that all civilization would be encompassed by love, and that would be the realization of the brotherhood of man.
Oh, yeah. See, I remember reading that, and I think that a lot of that verbiage and that language expresses perfectly what I definitely experienced.
Right.
You know, what? So as I moved out of my, I say it this way, Jesus taught us self-forgetting as the way of, the way to him, the way to follow him was to forget ourselves. And how do we do that? Well, we forget ourselves in service to our brothers and sisters. And that's really the only time I can forget myself. Well, there's one other time, and I'll mention that, and that is in true worship. In true worship, and I've not been able to get to that place that often, but occasionally in my meditation time, which is still with me today, that habit of twice a day, I mean, I still sometimes even pull the cover over my head, my own bed. It's interesting how that, you know, it takes me back to that place
when you're sharing a dorm room with 8 to 12 other men and the lights on all the time. I mean, there are all these ways that I can imagine how just pulling the sheet up over your head is the way you find a little privacy.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. And they would come in. After a while, I stood up to – they would come in there into our cell cursing and throwing that bad language, and I would come out of that meditation. I'd say, you stop that. If you want to talk like that, you go into your own house. This is my house, I would tell them. You had to be bold. I mean, Jesus was not a wimp like a lot of religions make him out to be. He was bold, and he didn't put up with it. I mean, I got bold on occasion. I said, take that nasty mouth and take it somewhere else. This is my house.
Good for
and,
you.
And, you know, they would walk off cursing. But after a while, when they came in, they saw me under my sheet, they would say, oh, Mr. Fox is praying. And they would turn around and leave. So they began to develop a respect for me. One of the things I did, I'll share this briefly, was I said, all right, well, how can we get these people to two things. One of the things that they did not know how to do was talk to each other. They just had never been learned how to actually listen to somebody else talking, right? So what I did was I had been in one of my journeys before had been exploring Native American spirituality, and one of the things that the Native peoples had in their rituals was the talking stick circle, where they would sit around and they had a stick. And whoever had the stick did the talking. Nobody else could talk if you had a stick. And you had the rule was that you had to talk, be honest, and talk from the heart. And so those are the only two rules, right? So I created talking stick circles in there where these guys were yelling at each other. And so we had these little, we didn't have a stick, right? So we had these little rubber pins that they gave us to write with.
So we used the pin, a little rubber pin, because they didn't want us to have real pins because, you know, you might stab somebody with a real pin. So it was the rubber pins. And so these guys that would argue with each other, I would call a circle. I'd say, all right, well, what's the issue here? Let's do a stick circle. All right, and I'd hold the pin out there. I'd say, who wants to talk first? And then I'd give them the rules, and they would hold the stick, and the person that would bring the issue up, whatever it was, and then the other people had to listen. Now, guess what? These folks started learning to listen to each other, and they would be so anxious to grab the stick. It was actually quite humorous to watch them, you know, and so they started learning at least a structure for listening instead of doing all the talking, which probably is something I need to still learn.
Well, to hear and be heard, you know. I mean, I think it's so basic for humans to be heard and to have a chance to say their story is vital, but also to have a chance to listen is also vital. So that's great.
So we would have these prayer circles, song circles, where one of the things I did, now they would have, you know, the people would gravitate towards their groups, like the Mexicans, the blacks, the whites, everybody would be gravitating towards their group. So one of the things I did in there was I invited everybody in all groups to get in one big circle, and we're going to pray together. And they about 90% of them did it, and you're talking about 50 men.
50,
60 men, something like that. And 90% of them joined the circle. And half of them, some of them prayed in Spanish. We all got, whoever wanted to pray out loud as we were all holding hands. Now, these are criminals, right? Holding hands in a big circle, praying to God. And some of them praying in Spanish, and we had no idea what they were saying. And then some
the
of them
spirit.
Just praying openly. Oh, my God, the spirit was so strong in there. And you could even, I remember one or two people who were sitting on the edge joined at the circle in the middle of it because they felt that spirit.
They felt it.
So we did that. And one other thing I did was I had a poetry contest. I'm a writer, so, I mean, I would journal and write, and sometimes I would see poems in my journaling, and I would develop them. And so me and one of the other UB readers, Michael Ford, who's still locked up, who I still communicated with, we got together, and I said, let's have a poetry contest. And he helped me design it, and we were going to be the judges of the poetry. And we passed out a sign-up sheet, and about 14 people signed up to be in. And the giveaway was, you know, some sweets and some ramen soup noodles and first, second, and third place, right? Because I was a man that had support from the outside. I had people sending money into my commissary account. I had goodies. I had drinks. I had Dr. Peppers. I had candy. I had all the things. I mean, I had it all. It was such a pleasure to give all that away when I left there to those people.
Uh-huh.
But the thing was, is I had this poetry contest, and about 14 of them signed up, and then, 15 signed up, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 backed out of it. And then, I told these guys, I said, all right, we're gonna judge the poems, and I gave them time to write the poem, and then I said, all right, we're gonna come together, and we're gonna all read our poems, and I'll say who the winner is. So we had three winners, but to hear everybody, we all got together after that, and in a circle, we all, similar to the talking stick, I said, now whoever is reciting, nobody else gets to say anything. And so 10 of these men sat around reciting their heartfelt words to their fellows. And I think I'd just like to read one of them.
Oh, my, yes.
I hope you will read me. There's so many of them that I've just fallen in love with that I hope you can read at least a couple.
Are these in your book,
well,
Matthew?
Here's one of
First
them.
In Mind and Heart, are they in your book?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. First
oh,
in
good,
the Mind
great.
And Heart. Yes, they're all in my book because I told those guys, I said, look, I'm going to be publishing these poems one of these days.
Oh, cool.
I had no idea I was even writing a book.
You were just writing in your journal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
here the poems are in the book. I mean, they're here in their own writing. I scanned them,
and they're not, you know, scans of the actual poems.
Well, let's get a couple of them in if we can.
Yeah, where are we? We only got 7 minutes. This is kind of a long one, but I'll read a long one and a short one. All right, this one is called Finding Peace. This is Vinny Salazar. Vinny was a little guy.
Oh, that's one of my favorite ones.
Yeah, Finding Peace. Here I am again, another night with not much sleep, laying silently in this cold bed that has no emotions, listening to conversations being whispered all around about outcomes, hopes, and wishes desired from everyone. Proves to be the only way to get some relief around here. Several months here, and it's not getting any warmer or closer to bringing fresh air or seeing daylight. Again, I just lay here in bed at night, knowing that I am a prisoner of the law, hoping to one day be free. Does it emotionally stress me out? Yes. Feels like someone grabs my heart and squeezes it until it no longer beats, making it hard to breathe, and even easier for this cruel place to trap and control my emotions. I have lots of anger inside. I never knew I could hate everything as much as I do, this hell. I want to scream, but instead I lay in bed and listen to other people's conversations, butting in from time to time for distraction, but only in my mind. For comfort, I go to God, knock on his door to ask the same thing I seem to be repeating more and more each day. God, please help me. I'm in the dark. I'm in the dark. Shine your light on me so I can find my way home. Take my hand. Guide me down the right path. I know he hears me because it quiets the voice that screams from inside my mind, heart, and soul, slowly putting me to sleep. It feels like heaven, so fresh, so soft, so pure, peace at last. Mentally preparing to start another day by knocking on God's door, hoping to be the first in line, waiting for him to answer, so I can ask the same questions I do every day. God, please help me. I'm in the dark. Shine your light on me so I can find my way home. Take my hand. Guide me down the right path. I know he hears me.
Beautiful.
I get choked up every time I read that.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's very, very powerful. Another one, a little bit lighter. We'll just do this. This one. This was actually a runner-up, or I can't remember this guy either won or he was a runner-up. It's called "Friend," and it was by Philip Bowen. "Friend," it's called. It says, "This is well done." I thought it was a hot thirst of a day when I stopped in the corner store. By the way, you were cooling in a root beer suit in rank with others. We cash in and walk out. My thirst was gone, and you hit the ground. We played kick the can down the street. That's the way to treat a friendly drink. I just thought those images are, you know, the guy walks into a store and he goes and gets him a root beer and he drinks it and he kicks the can down the street. I mean, it's just such a great little image there, and he was one of the winners.
I
think that just to end up here, we're close to an end. I just want to just reiterate that, you know, what I learned, this is probably the worst and the most marvelous experience of my life.
Yeah.
Because it taught me that we as human beings can rise above any circumstance. There's a part in the Urantia book where Jesus tells Peter or Andrew, maybe, I don't forget which one, he says, what is it to you if civilizations crumble and fall?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quoting it exactly, but don't you know that you are a son of God? You're an eternal son of God? So whatever we find our situations, conditions we find ourselves in here are temporary. All of it is temporal here. And we can gain the eternal perspective through our prayers and our meditation and our effort to, and then that will catapult us into a new way of life that leads us home and leads us onward. And so
and we can do that for others. We can help others just as you did. And I want to get in your book, First in the Mind and Heart, A True Story About the Resilience of the Human Spirit. We've been talking to Wayland Matthew Fox, and I hope you guys go out and get his book. It sounds wonderful. I know I'm going to get it. I can't wait to read it, Matthew. Thank you so much for being on the show. You know, it's been a delight to have you.
Well, it, you know, and I didn't get, you guys didn't get to talk a lot, but, you know, I hope I had a lot to say. All right.
You were a great guest.
We didn't get to
be on the lookout
the
next
stories.
Week. Be on. I want to tell the readers to be on, or the listeners to be on the lookout for next week. Bill Sadler has a great ministry in the prison system, so I'm putting in a blurb for him.
Great.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Matthew.
Okay.
You're,
all right.
I just
thank
got
you.
A new hero in my life. You've become one of my heroes.
Oh.
Thank you. Appreciate
it. Well, I'm looking forward to getting to know all of you better.
And
so we'll
and
talk,
Matthew,
again soon.
I hope that
yes.
at some point in the future that you'll be able to come on and share more of the personal stories and experiences that you had while you were there.
Right.
Because
yeah,
I know
there's
so many that we didn't get a chance to get to.
Yeah.
And
that's true.
I hope we will.
It's rich. All right. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Matthew.
Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Okay, you guys have a pleasant rest of the weekend. We'll talk soon.
You too.
Thanks again for sharing your story. God bless.
Okay. God bless. Bye-bye.
Well, and that's
bye-bye.
It for another episode of The Cosmic Citizen.
And just so our readers or our listeners know, we are doing a series on prison ministry for the next 3 weeks at least. So please tune in next week to hear William Sadler talk about his prison ministry.
That'll be
wonderful.
Great.
Look forward to seeing that, and we'll have the blurb up shortly, I assume.
All right. Until
next
week,
time.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.
Okay. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.